This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Topher, Principal Architect of Topher Architecture, and you're listening to New Books Architecture, a podcast channel on the New Books Network dedicated to architecture and its publications. If you have any suggestions on authors who you'd love to hear me speak with next, feel free to send me an email at btopher@topherarchitecture.com. Today's guest is Ehsan Abushadi to talk about her book that she co-authored, The Architecture of Ramses Wissa Wassef. Ehsan is an architect specializing in heritage at Megawa, and I know I mispronounced that. During her studies, she worked at the Regional Architecture Collection of the Rare Books and Special Collections Library of the American University in Cairo. The book was co-authored by Conchita Añorve Chergi. Ehsan, thank you very much for being here with me and talking today. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So before we begin, can you tell us a little bit more about yourself?
Well, I studied architecture at the American University in Cairo, and that's where I met Conchita. During my third year of study, I had applied for a work study position at the library archive, and I was assigned to the architecture collection where Conchita was the curator. And that's where Wissa Wassef's archive is like held. So during my third year of architecture studies, I applied for a work study position at the library archive, where I met Conchita, who is the curator of the architecture collection. Initially, I worked on the archive of Gamal Bekri, a postmodernist Egyptian architect, as well as Kamel Amin, who was a student of Frank Lloyd Wright, as these were newly acquired collections that needed processing. But during my time there, Conchita and I became very close. She became a very good mentor. And so once I graduated, we decided to write a book on Ramses Wissa Wassef together. So we started writing the book about Ramses Wissa Wassef, who's an Egyptian architect that was rediscovering what Egyptian architecture is in the mid-20th century, especially focusing on local materials, local craft, and local heritage. And he's most known for the Ramses Wissa Wassef Art Center, as well as the Mahmoud Mukhtar Museum, and then two of his churches, Coptic Orthodox churches, one based in Zamalek, Cairo, and the other one in Heliopolis. Despite like being like a very well-known architect in Egypt, very little is known about his architecture, and that's what drove us to write this book.
All right, great. And so that you kind of took my, you kind of already read my mind on the first question. You know, I'll admit that in my 7 years of architecture school, I've never heard of Ramses, and I'm going to take a guess a lot of North American architecture students haven't. However, his story is very interesting. And so the first thing I found very interesting is, you know, most architects I know, they do have an interest for art, and they might even practice some art, except for most of us, it never leaves our offices as a hobby. Whereas it seems like in Ramses' work, it's most of his architecture is based around the intersection of art and education, or art and architecture.
Yes. There are a few examples where he did focus on like a lot of architectural details that were kind of borderline with like craftsmanship or like artistic fields. So he did design like a lot of stained glass windows for residential buildings as well as religious buildings. He did work on like some ceramic pieces as well as stucco pieces for like ceiling fixtures, lighting fixtures, just wall decorations. He even did like some carpentry design. So he was quite versatile in like how much of the building he designed.
And a follow-up to that is, at least from what I could tell, and it does talk about this in the book, it seems like almost all of his residential projects were always for the residents of some craftsman, whether it's weavers or potters or farmers, which we could say is a craftsperson. And so I guess I'm just curious over a little more elaboration. You know, why is that? Is that a personal choice? Was it because of his own passion?
Well, in the 1950s, he started to develop the Ramses Wissa Wassef Art Center. He did feel that like children had like an innate sense of creativity, which he wanted to nurture. So he created this space where like children could like learn to weave and express their creativity without like any formal art education. And as like some of these weavers grew, he did build some houses for them. So that's like one aspect. And then in that same kind of like rural area, he did also design some houses for some of his art students. He was a professor at the Faculty of Fine Arts. And so like at the time, like a lot of these like up-and-coming artists were looking to like also like, you know, have their houses like in that rural area. And him being like their professor designed a couple of them.
And so you mentioned that he was a professor. And so I let it slip in my last question when I accidentally said education. But of course, later on in the book, he does seem to have the passion of art, architecture, and education. And so there's a lot of case studies in here, and sadly, we just can't go through them all. But the ones I found in particular interest were the ones that, as an educator myself, I thought were very interesting, that he had his students participate in the construction, or children as well. I know some of the examples that stand out most in my mind are the chicken coops or silos. And so the question I have for you then is, you know, from my understanding, these projects are still standing, even though they were built by children and students. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So like in parallel, while he was teaching these children weaving, he was also teaching them to use like how to make mud brick, how to build with it, you know, like making sure the structural stability of like domes and vaults. So since a lot of these were children, they can't really, you know, start building a house. It's out of their scale. They can't really reach. So he started with like small projects that would be manageable for like a child's height. And so like the silos and the chicken coops are like low-lying structures that were easy for the children to practice on. And And so, like, over the years, like, Wissa Wasif, like, did have, like, his own team of mud brick builders that he would use for, like, all his mud brick structures.
Great. And you hinted at this before, and so I want to come back to it. You had mentioned that his use of local materials, and again, going back to him being faculty, you know, there you talk about the trip he took with students that kind of opened his eyes, we'll say, to local building materials and sustainability, even ahead of their time a little bit. And so one thing I found very interesting was the idea that his buildings are very distinct and that a regional Egyptian style. However, the political landscape was that most of Egypt was trying to mimic Europe, particularly politically and building wise. And so I'd love to hear more about the fact that his buildings, while they are of a regional style, they actually stood out because they were a regional style in a region trying to pretend to be somewhere else.
Yeah, well, at the time, like, Egypt was very cosmopolitan. So, like, especially in Cairo, there were a lot of Italians, a lot of French, Greeks, and, like, Egyptians and Turkish. The architecture was very much influenced by, like, Europe. At the time, like, there were a lot of scholarships for architecture students to study at the Beaux-Arts in France, which included Wissa Wasif and Hassan Fathi. So they studied there and, like, received a kind of European formation in architecture, and then they came back. And so, like, all these different, like, influences were taking place in Cairo, you know, like the Greek and the Italian and the French. Both of them, Hassan Fathi and Ramses Wissa Wasif, went on this trip to, like, Upper Egypt in Nubia, where they kind of, like, rediscovered this traditional architecture and tried to, like, think about, you know, this new traditional Egyptian identity for architecture that was not as influenced by, like, the European styles.
Right. And as I had mentioned, you know, he actually employs a lot of passive heating and cooling strategies. You know, again, at a time where that was not, you know, nowadays sustainability and passive cooling is kind of buzzwords that every project uses. However, the time frame of these buildings, it is somewhat revolutionary. You know, in particular, I'd love to hear more about the passive heating and cooling strategies in buildings that don't have the same mechanical systems we have here in North America.
Yes. So, like, some of his mud brick structures, like, already, like, they have you know, the regular passive cooling systems that we know, you know, like having high ceilings, vaulted ceilings, or domed ceilings to like facilitate like air circulation, the rising of hot air away from like the space that's being used. But he did also like implement other like lesser known systems. He would have like some buildings that had a double wall system, which would prevent like hot air from entering, like warming up the walls and warming up the inside. In the Habib Gorgi Museum, for example, he used the system twofold. So not only to contribute to the cooling of the building, but also this double wall was designed in such a way that indirect light would come in and light up the niches where like some of the sculptures were being exhibited.
Right, absolutely. And so you mentioned, we talked about the museum a little bit, and we've hinted at probably his most known work, and I think we should kind of try to steer back. You had mentioned his most known project being the Ramses Wissa Wasif Art Center. And this is an important project, not just for his style, but for all the artistic contributions it had many years later.
Yes. So like at this center and like up until today, they continue to produce like a lot of tapestries that show different like traditional and contemporary like scenes of Egyptian life, especially like rural life. And a lot of these tapestries have actually like been exhibited at like many international exhibitions. So, like, this center, like, it's known, internationally for its tapestries more than for its architecture. And I think that was one of the driving points for this book, you know, to like kind of like highlight the architectural work that this artist produced. So at the center, like apart from having like the galleries and the studios or like these tapestries are created, there's also like a couple of houses that he built for himself, for his daughter's father-in-law and like his sister. And apart from like in Egypt, this might be like the most well-known, followed by the Mahmoud Mukhtar Museum that was built for one of Egypt's more famous like sculptors, as well as the Marashli Church in Zemelik, which was also like a highlight for like contemporary Coptic Orthodox church architecture.
Right. And so you had hinted before that, and I think it was actually before the interview, so I should, but you had mentioned that he actually can be a little more well-known in circles outside of the architecture community. And I think you had said that in particular, his stained glass window work, is that correct? Or was it other realms that he would be more well-known in?
Yes. So, well, a lot of his buildings are well-known for his stained glass projects, although they might not, a lot of people might not necessarily know that these are attributed to him. I think like some of his projects are very famous without a lot of people associating them to him. Maybe like only architects might know this. And even then, like a lot of architects will focus more on the architecture than the stained glass. So it's kind of very interesting how like the different, like this understanding of who he is as a person is very fragmented in the field. So like the artist will only focus on like the art, the architects will only focus on the architecture, and the educators will like focus on like his pedagogy.
And so, as I said, you know, there's plenty of case studies, both for his built work and some of his non-extant stuff. Great photographs. Sadly, we won't be able to do that, especially with the listeners not having the book in front of them. But so the question I have, though, is, you know, as we wrap up, so since the book's been released, what have you been working on? What projects have kind of occupied your time since the book's been released?
Well, I'm currently pursuing a master's degree. So I've kind of been working on my thesis, which is focused on underground water in Cairo, and looking at like water structure, so particularly like cisterns.
Very interesting. Perhaps we could talk about that again in the future if you release something.
Hopefully.
Well, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with me today.
Yeah, thank you.
And for everyone listening, the book is The Architecture of Ramses Wiso Wassef. I want to thank everyone for listening and hope everyone has a great day.